Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Today's episode is brought to you by Plexaderm and my ZipRecruiter. And of course, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to this podcast by going to iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, as all kinds of other places you could do it. And I want to say thank you to all of our guests and all of our listeners. Since we launched in January, we crossed the 5 million download mile marker, which exceeded my expectations, and I think probably a lot of others as well. So we're going to really wonk out today. I think we're overdue for a number crunching poll geek fest. And how about that for an introduction, David? David Beiler, data analyst and political columnist for the Washington Post, and one of our former colleagues from the Weekly Standard. So good to have you back, David.
Great to be here.
Yeah, so data analyst and political columnist. This is like a new thing, right? Political columnists who actually know stuff, who actually crunch numbers. Is this going to be like a trend?
I have no idea if it's going to be a trend, but it's a really fun thing. I'm enjoying it. The Post is letting me do my stat stuff and write all kinds of things, and it's a fun time.
Okay, so let's just dive right into this. There is a new Monmouth poll that has a lot of people's eyebrows going up, showing a rather substantial drop for Joe Biden. So first of all, let's talk about this Monmouth poll. Does it indicate that Joe Biden is in some sort of a free fall or has some problems?
Yeah, so the best way to look at polls that seem like outliers is kind of tentatively. Every new trend begins with a poll that seems like an outlier. So it's possible that Joe Biden is mid-crash. It's possible that Monmouth just got some wonky numbers. That's not an entirely clear thing. We need more polling to know for sure. But, it's also kind of a weird case because you have indicators going in multiple directions, right? Like it's a relatively low sample size poll with margin of error. But at the same time, Monmouth is one of the best pollsters in the country in terms of past accuracy, in terms of methodology. And so
okay, before people start screaming at us, let's just run through the top line numbers while we're talking about this. Bernie Sanders 20%, Warren 20%, Biden now in third place at 19%, Kamala Harris at 8%, Booker at 4%, Mayor Pete at 4%, Andrew Yang at 3%, Castro at 2%. I have to go down this to just remind myself that some of these people are still running. Beto O'Rourke is at 2%. tied with Marianne Williamson. De Blasio has finally broken through zero. He's at 1%. Tulsi Gabbard 1%. Klobuchar 1%. But obviously, people are looking at that top line. Biden really in a statistical three-way tie with Warren and Sanders, which is really the first major national poll showing him without having a lead. So I'm sorry. I wanted to make sure that people understood. So, I mean, at the moment, it's an outlier. But so what are you looking at?
Yeah. So what I'm looking for are a couple things. One is in the polls that come out over the next couple of days, do we see a downward movement for Biden? I'm looking for kind of that change, not just his absolute level, but also where he is, where he's going. I'm interested in the direction of Warren and Sanders as well, because people lump them together because they've got some similar, similarities in their ideology, but they have pretty different trajectories and pretty different sort of political strategies and kind of means of persuasion and sort of theories of how politics should work. So I'm looking for all of those things, but yeah, I mean, Elizabeth Warren's strategy seems to be to do, a new policy rollout on a pretty regular schedule, build support steadily. Biden seems to be, a prevent defense sort of holding pattern strategy. And, it's possible that those things have both sort of broken, that Biden's strategy is sort of, not working as well from as he planned and that Warren's is continuing to take off. It's just a thing where we need more data, but, movement is plausible. We're in the phase where that can happen.
Okay, since I promised we were going to be wonky here, the sample size is getting a little bit of attention. There are people who are basing their skepticism that this is a smaller sample size, more questionable sample size than some of the other national polls that we've cited.
Yeah, so it's oftentimes hard to get, as big of a sample size as you would want. And essentially, when you have sample sizes that are smaller, your margin of error inflates. You have a greater likelihood of accidentally picking out a group of people that are just kind of wacky and weird and getting numbers that are, you know, kind of off. It's the reason why you don't ever do a poll of 5 people or 10 people. And obviously Monmouth did a poll of way, way more than that. But, you know, that's one of the sources of skepticism of it. But yeah, it's this is sort of the pattern with all changes, is that they all start with something that looks like an outlier, and you have to see whether or not it holds up.
Yeah, so this is the problem that all pundits have of overanalyzing. We can now spend the next 20 minutes talking about, okay, are we seeing a shift in the race from the pragmatism, electability, to some other momentum narrative, when in fact it may not actually be taking place. So let's not do this. So let's talk about the Democratic primary race in general. I mean, is it feels like it's still very, very early. But so, I mean, what is it that we actually can know about this race? Are there a couple of patterns, leaving the Monmouth poll out that you feel comfortable talking about?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. So one thing that I did recently was kind of a dive into historical polling data. And what I decided to do was just, you know, chuck thinking about ideology for a second, chuck all the demographics for a second, and just look at sort of historically, if a candidate is ahead right now, how often do they win? And if, you know, you have the top four candidates, how often does the nominee come from that group? And just sort of baseline questions that sort of can set our expectations. And essentially what I found is that in past primary elections, the person who is leading now wins a little bit over half of the time. So it's not too early for the polls to tell you something. And I also found that the nominee almost always comes from the top three or four candidates by this point. That's not an iron rule. You know, it's a low sample size because we've only had primaries that look like our modern system.
Did we mention what the sample size of Monmouth was, though?
Oh, yeah. I don't have that pulled up in front of me. It was a couple hundred.
Yeah, I'm looking at a tweet that says there were 298 registered voters who identify as Democrat. 298?
Yeah.
In the country?
The basic idea is that you can get a representative sample from a relatively small number. But that's why you have, in the next sentence, a 5.7% sampling margin of error.
Jeez. Man.
That's real. Yeah.
You know, for some reason, we're talking about, it's a low sample size. I wasn't thinking, like, under 300.
Yeah, it's on the lower end of things. But, you know, again, conflicting indicators to mom that's a really... they have a really solid record of success, so we'll see.
Okay, so you don't want to dunk on them, but it's like, well, let's wait here. But as you point out, though, there is an historical reason. I mean, you know, the thing is that you know, I said I wasn't going to do this, but the Biden lead has been very, very durable, with the exception of this poll, and you know, going into the fall. And as you point out, you know, people who have led for this long often do pretty well.
Yeah, that's true. And Biden's doing something that I think is kind of interesting, in the sense that his demographic, the people that he is most likely to appeal to, the people who are more likely to like him, are not necessarily the people who always show up in sort of the news sphere, Twitter conversation. So the demographics of sort of the Twitterverse don't really match the demographics of Biden world perfectly. A lot of Democrats who identify themselves as moderate or conservative are behind him. A lot of older voters are behind him. He does well with older African-American voters. He kind of has this, you could call it maybe like an anti-Twitter coalition almost, of people who, when you're online and you're watching people debate about Medicare for all versus the public option, so on and so forth, Biden is, there's some similarity almost to Trump's strategy there as well, in that he has cornered a piece of the sort of Democratic electorate that's underserved, while a lot of his competitors are sort of going for the other slice of the electorate. And I mean, I think that's a pretty smart strategy. And if the other polls are right and Monmouth is off, then it's working for him, you know?
So let's talk about the... Since we're having a little bit of signal noise here because of the Monmouth poll, let's talk about the general election. Mm-hmm. And you've written about I have to admit, I mean, obviously I'm from Wisconsin, so I've been arguing that the election is going to be decided in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. But there's been a lot of attention to Texas. And I guess I keep coming back to this question. Is that for real? What is your gut sense about the trends in Texas?
Yeah. So I've looked into the data on Texas, and I think the trend is real, but the position is not exactly where people think about it. You know, there's a difference between kind of the velocity of the state and where it is presently. So what you see when you look into the actual data on Texas is pretty different than the narrative, right? Hmm. The narrative is there's a growing Hispanic population and the cities are all growing, right? And Democrats have been, you know, patiently waiting and building on Texas for a while. What you really see in Texas is Republicans gaining strength, holding steady through basically the entirety of the Obama era, and then tanking and losing a bunch of their support. It's still a red state, but losing a bunch of their support once Donald Trump gets the nomination. Essentially, in the pre-Trump era, the Republicans were able to, you know, offset growth in the Democratic-leaning Latino population by converting various white voters, by, in some cases, in some, for some statewide candidates, doing well with Latino voters. They were able to sort of keep the state red by doing well in classic Republican mm-hmm. suburbs. But you saw when Trump got the nomination, a lot of sort of the traditional backbone GOP voters, a lot of the people who really liked Mitt Romney, said, I'm not signing up for this. And you had a pretty big loss between 2012 and 2016 for Republican support. It's still a red state. In 2018, everyone points to Beto O'Rourke only losing the Senate seat by a couple of points, but there's context there. The House Republicans, yeah. Sorry, what?
And he did lose.
He did lose. Yeah, I mean... And the House Republicans lost by 8-9 points nationally at that same time. So it was a bad year for the Republicans, and Cruz still won. So it's still like a light red state. The way that I would put it is that Texas right now is in a position where Democrats could win it in 2020. But if they're winning in Texas in 2020, the race is already over. They've got all their electoral votes from other places that they need them. Texas is on the urban side of the urban-rural divide, but it hasn't really transitioned as hard and as far as I think some people say it has.
Yeah, I mean, so if it's a landslide nationally, you could imagine Texas going, but then so many other states have gone as well. So your analysis, if I'm reading this correctly, is don't get distracted. It's still going to be the big industrial states, still going to be Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, et cetera.
That's exactly right. Yeah. If you look at historically, we're in a pretty stable era of swing states, and we're in a pretty stable era of, you know, swing voters and people being polarized and all that everyone always talks about. But usually from one election to the next, a lot of the swing states stay the same. So it would be pretty easy to assume, based on history, that Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, Florida, these states that we all worry about, that the 270th electoral vote, the vote that the winner really needed to get, is going to come from those votes. And I think that in some cases, I think people in sort of the Democratic world sometimes want to skip around those states and want to kind of avoid the issue of trying to win back the Obama to Trump voter. But
now, why would they do that?
So I don't want to put people who I have read, if it's someone who I've just read their stuff or I've just seen them on Twitter, I don't want to like put them on the couch or whatever. But I think that there are a lot of people for whom a different image of the Democratic Party is appealing, right? One that is less focused on blue collar whites who are conservative on social, cultural, and racial issues, but liberal on economics. Maybe you chuck them in favor of a party that is more reliant than it currently is on non-white voters, on suburbanites, so on and so forth. It's kind of a desire for a party that's shaped differently. But, you know, the demographics are what they are in the country. It's not 2040 yet, right?
No, that's right. And the demographics are what they are. And this is an important point. I mean, you know, that strategy can run up huge margins in many of your already blue states. I mean, it can run up big margins in California and New York. But I have to tell you that if you're writing off that kind of a constituency in a place like Wisconsin, I don't see how that's going to be a winning strategy, because, quite frankly, there are, you know, there are a lot of, you know, progressive voters who live in, you know, places like Madison, Wisconsin. There are a lot of African-American voters who live in Milwaukee. But if you write off blue-collar white voters and rural voters in the rest of the state, we're still a, you know, a blue-collar, heavily rural state. It's hard to imagine how you're going to flip Wisconsin back. In fact, it seems like almost designed to be a strategy not to win a state like Wisconsin back.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that whoever the Democratic nominee is would be pretty smart to run some things that were essentially out of the Barack Obama playbook, right? It would be, I think, smart for them to say, hey, Trump promised so on and so forth economically, but he did a tax cut bill that favors people who are not like you. He attempted to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. Go for the competence argument. Go for the basic economics argument. And I think those are less flashy than some of the other strategies, but I think they're ultimately winning strategies, you know?
Yeah, I think so. So what is your sense about, is there much meaningful polling going on in those states? I'm trying to think of the last Wisconsin poll I saw that I can't recall what the actual result was.
So there's a couple interesting things about the polling right now. One is that Trump is unpopular, so the polling is going to be bad everywhere. It makes sense. If he's unpopular nationally, you're going to have some rough numbers out of Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Michigan and so on and so forth. He's at 42 to 43% approval rating. That's not good. The other thing is that polls taken right now of the horse race are not super predictive of what ends up happening in the general election in 2020. That doesn't mean that we don't know anything. We do know that a couple things about electability and about ideology and about Trump's, the stability of Trump's approval rating, and basically a couple nuggets. We know that in House and Senate races in the past, we have data that suggests that voters like candidates who are closer to the center. So if Democrats are serious about the electability argument, I think that should be priced in somewhere. We know that in some recent polls, we've seen, I'm blanking on the citation for this, but we've seen voters who dislike the Democratic nominee, I think it was Joe Biden in the specific poll, and Trump, who dislike both of them, breaking for the Democrat instead of for Trump.
I think that was the Fox News poll, right? Because that was a very scary number, I thought, for Trump world.
Oh yeah, because that's what Trump is banking on, right? He's banking on the idea that through his own efforts or through the Democratic candidate's own ideological positioning, that the Democrat will be too far left or unacceptable for some reason, and that he'll get some of those same voters who didn't like him last time but voted for him because they also didn't like Hillary Clinton. And yeah, that's a pretty rough number for Trump. I mean, he's just weaker than your average incumbent president. I think 50-50 is still my sort of line and where I have it, same as when I talked to you last time. But yeah, it's still 50-50, but that's not good for an incumbent. Incumbents usually win sort of in the modern era.
Well, that leads my next question, which was the durability of Trump's numbers. It's sort of legendary that Trump's numbers never seem to move out of a very, very narrow range. They appear to be at the bottom of that range right now. But I mean, it is plausible for him to get those numbers, say, to 43% of the vote and be reelected, right? I mean, it may sound counterintuitive, but you can be a president of the United States with a 43% approval rating. You can even lose by 3 points in the popular vote and still be reelected, right?
I think, you know, if the Trump camp wants to be, you know, wants to feel safer about all of this, I think that they would want his approval rating to go up a couple points. It is possible to lose the popular vote and win the Electoral College, maybe by a couple points. At the same time, if that's your sort of starting play. If that's your beginning strategy, that's not a great sign. If you go into the room saying, yeah, we're gonna get less votes than the other guy, let's see how we can win, that's not great.
It is like saying, I really can draw to an inside straight again.
Yeah. And so Trump, the thing is that his approval rating could be higher if he, well, maybe this is a contradiction, but it could be higher if he just had more self-control or was able to govern more competently. These aren't hard fixes to get his numbers up, like stay out of the news. It's the whole Trump era is just kind of a study in political malpractice in some ways. And
well, it is extraordinary. And tell me about, because I know you're a student of history, when someone has had economic numbers this strong and the approval rating this low. I mean, that is remarkable.
Yeah.
Almost any other president would be in the 60s, wouldn't they? I mean, it's really quite an achievement to be this low with the economy up until now being this strong.
It's really, really interesting. And yeah, his numbers, you know, should be higher than they are given where the economy is. But what I've seen is kind of an interesting trend where for a lot of past presidents, their approval rating lined up pretty well with sort of top line economic numbers like GDP and so on and so forth. But during the Obama era, that started to decouple a little bit and the economy started to exert sort of less influence on Obama's approval rating. And now during the Trump era, you know, like you said, the economy is great, but he's at 40-something%. So, yeah.
Okay. I want to dive more deeply into this because, you know, this has been our model that we've used for several decades now, which is the economy stupid. And now there are numbers out showing, I think there's a new NBC poll showing that majority of Americans are now, you know, anxious about the future. They're not that optimistic. And so I want to talk to you about that. But first, let's hear a word from our two sponsors today. Hiring is challenging, you know that, but there's one place where you can go where hiring is simple, fast, and smart. A place where growing businesses connect to qualified candidates, and that place is ZipRecruiter.com/Bulwark. ZipRecruiter sends your job to more than 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. With our powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. And right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address. Did I say it's for free? ZipRecruiter.com/Bulwark. That's ZipRecruiter.com/Bulwark. BULWARK. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Okay, picture your face in the mirror. Do you see all those wrinkles around your eyes? How about the crow's feet or those large under-eye bags? Now imagine they're gone. I'm not talking about some risky, expensive surgery. Just gone in minutes. It's called Plexiderm, a clinically studied serum that visibly eliminates your wrinkles, crow's feet, and under-eye bags in minutes. It's the edge you've been looking for. Plexiderm can give you the confidence you'll need to be yourself at work or out with friends. And the best part is, Plexiderm goes on clear so nobody will know you're using it unless you tell them. Go to TryPlexiderm.com and use my code BULWARK for 50% off plus an additional $10 off. That's right, 50% off plus an additional $10 off. This offer is also available by calling 1-800-685-1292 and mentioning code word BULWARK. Plexiderm is backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. Visit TryPlexiderm.com today and use code BULWARK at checkout. That's TryPlexiderm.com. Okay, we're back with David Byler, data analyst and political columnist for The Washington Post. We're talking about the durability of President Trump's numbers. They just never seem to move that much. How low they are considering how good the economy is. So I guess the question is, given the decoupling between these poll numbers and economics, how much would a really wobbly economy affect Trump's numbers? I mean, has he immunized himself, or is that the only thing that's keeping him afloat?
So I don't think he's immunized himself. If you look into, so in a lot of these approval disapproval polls, they break it down into strong approvers and somewhat approvers, or strong and weak, and sort of metrics along those lines. And what you can see is among the Trump disapprovers, there's a lot of strong disapprovers. There are not a lot of people who are like, I sort of don't like Trump. The people who don't like Trump typically really don't like him.
So what are we at now? Did I see the number, something like 46% of Americans strongly disapprove of Trump? Is it that big a number?
Yeah, something like that.
That's hard. That's impermeable.
Yeah, that's pretty tough. But what you've noticed in, or what I've noticed in his approval ratings is it fluctuates over time and the exact numbers sort of vary, but it's not the same. There are actually a decent number of somewhat approving Republicans or somewhat, you know, Trump approving people who are sort of medium on him, sort of conditionally supportive, and are okay, presumably because things are going well and presumably because the economy is going well. So I do think that if the bottom fell out, that he would take some damage and that things would look significantly worse for him economically.
So how much damage? What is his hard floor that you mean?
That's a great question. I would guess, if I had to just put a wild guess on it, I would guess probably low 30s, high 20s, maybe.
Oh, really? That low? See, I thought you were going to say something like 36. So you think it really drops below that?
Maybe. I think so, because we've already seen him get into the high 30s before during other times of self-invented crisis, right? When he's constantly pushing a healthcare bill that, whatever you believe the merits are, pulled really, really poorly. We've seen him at his lowest points get under that 40% number and some of the averages. And so this is my gut guess. I haven't backed this one up with like a complicated regression or something like that. But you could foresee this getting relatively bad for Trump. And yeah, he has very little expansionary strategy. It's like he is trapped in his strategy from the Republican primary of 2016 and just hasn't ever gotten out of it and has been stumbling around ever since.
So the only thing, I'm just bouncing this off, you tell me whether you agree or disagree, because there's almost nothing that you can expand his approval rating. And he's not apparently even trying to do that. But it sounds like the only thing that could really drop that floor is going to be the bad economic news, because it's not the racism, it's not the lying, it's not the erratic narcissism, right? It is the prospect that the 401ks are going south, that unemployment might tick up, that there's the trade war just causes massive jitters. People no longer are optimistic about the future. So that's really is that the only thing that could get him down to that floor of low 30s.
I tend to think bungling a massive international crisis of some sort is another thing that might be able to do it. I don't know exactly what that would
nuking a hurricane
look like. potentially.
We just don't know. I mean, it's really, 48 hours ago, you didn't think we were thinking about nuking hurricanes. Now it's,
It's true. And last week, I didn't think we were talking about buying Greenland, but, every day is a new adventure.
I'm waiting for Tom Cotton to come out and say, no, that was my idea to nuke the hurricanes.
I think that, like, bungling foreign crisis, having some kind of economic downturn, I think those would be sort of the primary candidates. Some of the other things that have happened related to Russia were a little bit stress testing the scandal sort of potential there to see if that could move his approval ratings down. So far, we haven't seen much of it. The one thing that I would add, though, is I do think there's a way for Trump to get his approval ratings up, which is just to like be quiet and be outside the news and just hang out and be on cruise control. But he seems really totally unwilling to do that. Beyond that, you could talk about infrastructure and so on and so forth. But that's a thing he seems even less interested in than just hanging out and being on cruise control.
Do you have a sense of how the gun issue is playing in a general election scenario? And by that, I'm particularly looking at the Electoral College. I know public opinion has clearly shifted rather dramatically on this issue. It's a real problem for Republicans in the suburbs. But going back to our previous conversation, you know, about blue collar voters, rural voters in places like Wisconsin, those issues like guns play very, very differently than they do in, say, you know, downtown Burlington, Vermont.
So the way that I sort of process this is that the gun issue does seem to have some movement, and you can trace that back to Parkland originally. Oftentimes, movement on the gun issue, though, is a little bit ephemeral. We'll have to see if this keeps up until next year, because there have been a lot of cases where there's a mass shooting and there's a spike in pro-gun control sentiment or something along those lines. And then essentially the news moves on, people think about other things, and that kind of goes away. This might break that pattern, but oftentimes, historically, that's what happens. I mean, and the other way to process this and people's opinions on this and positions on this is that it's just generally better to be a little bit closer to the center.
Yes.
If you can, on a position. Obviously, there's a trade-off here, and the Democratic Party wants to nominate actual Democrats. The Republicans want to nominate actual Republicans. They're not going to nominate someone who's a total moderate on every single issue. If you're a Democratic primary candidate trying to stake out your position, if you're thinking about the general election, it's worth thinking about areas where you can not go full tilt progressive on an issue, because just in general, people are able to digest the whole of your platform. They're able to sort of place where you are versus someone else. And so on the margins, these things matter.
Well, and also this is one of those issues where the intensity of the support matters a lot. It's not necessarily the top line. Are you in favor? Are you opposed? The people who are opposed new gun control legislation stick around. They are going to vote on that. They are going to be absolutely motivated on that. And I remember, you know, with the Democrats, post 2000, it felt like they went for quite a few election cycles not talking about gun control, because they understood how that played in rural Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, places like that. And I remember the very first time that it began to, I sort of had this creeping sense that, boy, could Donald Trump actually win in Wisconsin? I still didn't think he would. I want to make that clear. But I began to think, is it possible, when Hillary Clinton made it very clear that she would appoint a Supreme Court justice who would overturn the Heller decision, which is, you know, the key, you know, Second Amendment decision. It was that moment I thought, wow, okay, so the Democrats have decided that they don't need to worry about pro-gun voters in places, in places like the Upper Midwest. And well, and we know how that movie ended.
Yeah, and it's such an interesting thing, because buried in some of the polling, you can find that in some surveys, voters said that Donald Trump was closer to the political center than Hillary Clinton was. And that might sound crazy to some people, but if you think about politics and sort of a Romney versus Obama axis, Donald Trump had chucked, or at least, you know, kind of flirted with chucking a lot of things about fiscal conservatism. He had, you know, gone hard on immigration, but you could, you know, imagine a person evaluating him on those criteria and sort of being less sure, or seeing him as more, you know, moderate-ish than past Republicans, depending on your criteria. And I think that helped him. But, you know, the interesting thing is that since then, people's opinions on him have changed. They're rating him as more conservative, presumably because, you know, the tax bill, ACA repeal efforts, Supreme Court, so on and so forth. So we'll have to see. I mean, it's totally possible that we see some parts of the 2012 map kind of reasserting themselves in 2020.
So, David, you became world famous with your predictions about the U.S. Senate, and really very accurately called the 2018 election on the U.S. Senate. In fact, we're a little bit contrarian for a while there. Are you? I assume you're keeping a pretty close eye on what the Senate races in 2020 look like.
Yeah, so it's an interesting map. So the 2020 map is all the people from 2014 that won in that year and are up again. And 2014 was an excellent year for Republicans. People kind of don't remember this about 2014, but Obama's approval rating was low. People mm-hmm. were unhappy, and Republicans had a really, really great midterm that year, as well as in 2010, when, again, Obama was sort of unpopular around election time, and Republicans were able to gain a lot of seats.
Yeah.
So you have interesting things going in Arizona and North Carolina. You know, Democrats will talk up their chances in Texas. And I think that's, you know, kind of a marginally real thing. I think if Democrats are winning the presidency by a decent margin, the Senate is possible, but it also depends on the candidates and who they get in different races. I mean, John Hickenlooper is the exception to this rule, but some of the better Senate candidates that the Democrats have available are running for president.
It's interesting.
And
yes,
claim they're not going to.
Yeah.
It's, you know.
And Beto O'Rourke, who is obviously the top of that list, a lot of people, you know, pushing him to run for Senate, has made it absolutely positively clear that he has no interest in running for Senate, even though he's about, 2% in the latest poll. You know, kind of interesting how American politics has shifted, that people just think that running for the Senate is not a big enough deal for them.
Right. And I think so. I can't take credit for this. I forget who it was in the world of election wonks who said this one, but I thought you might appreciate it. Beto O'Rourke, you know, there's a case to be made that he is very electable, that he's a great fundraiser, he's charismatic, so on and so forth, that sort of thing. But I've heard the case, again, can't take credit for it, that Beto O'Rourke is basically Mark Hamill, right? That essentially he was put in a setting where no matter what happens, he was going to look great, right? It's the Texas Democratic Senate election in 2018 when, you know, Texas is shifting left and Democrats are excited and they've got a good year.
Ted Cruz.
Yeah, right. You're running against Ted Cruz. That's a lot like Mark Hamill, who gets cast in Star Wars. And that's a great franchise that's obviously always going to be legendary. But then when Star Wars is over, or when the Texas Senate race is over, everyone kind of looks at Mark Hamill slash Beto O'Rourke and is like, eh, it's possible that that's the case and that Beto could just sort of hang out in the presidential race and then fizzle.
Well, that's what's been happening. He's been, you know, that's the thing about running for president. It often exposes you in rather dramatic, unexpected ways. So it still looks like, even though the map would seem to be somewhat more favorable for the Democrats, it seems like a tall mountain for them at the moment. They need to pick up three seats, right?
You know, it varies a little bit depending on who the vice president
right.
is.
Yeah, four seats if you want to,
And all that, yeah. But what we've really got is a rural versus urban divide in the country. And that's behind a lot of the movement in Texas, is that Texas is, contrary to popular belief, full of large cities like, you know, Dallas, San Antonio, Houston, Austin, that those dominate the population. And, you know, the flip side of that is that there are a lot of relatively rural states, or states where there's rural and urban population sort of balancing each other out. And Republicans have kind of an advantage running the strategy that they run and running the coalition that they run.
Okay, so let's fantasize, which is always difficult.
Sure.
I know the data analysts don't like to do this, okay? But it's election night, 2020. And it's a really good night for Democrats in the U.S. Senate. What does it look like? What are they picking up? In order for them to win, do they have to pick up Arizona, pick up Colorado, maybe pick up Maine? What else are we looking at?
Colorado is going to be the first one on the list that is important for Democrats to try to pick up. That's one of their top targets. Maine is another one, though Maine's kind of a weird case. That state's kind of been shifting right, and it's a better fit for Trump than it is for a candidate like Mitt Romney.
And Susan Collins doesn't really fit in any category. So
So you're probably looking at races in North Carolina and Arizona as well. Arizona, you could argue maybe even before North Carolina, and you're looking maybe for something else to flip or pop somewhere, right? You're looking for maybe a Georgia, maybe if Steve Bullock decides not to run for president and runs a really great race in Montana, maybe something along there. You're kind of looking in a sort of battlegrounds plus sort of way. I think the Mitch McConnell thing is not going to happen. No. That's not. Yeah.
Alabama, the Democrats are going to lose a seat in Alabama, right?
Yes. Yeah. I think, you know, you never want to say never, but, you know, if Trump's at the top of the ticket, it's, I don't know how Doug Jones survives. Yeah. You know?
So fantasy night, you concede that you're going to lose Alabama, but you pick up Arizona, you pick up Colorado, you might pick up North Carolina, Georgia, and Montana. Well, that seems like a reach, though. My next line will be, and I get a unicorn.
Yeah. No? I mean, it's a hard situation for Democrats in the Senate until something happens that rejiggers the map a little bit, until someone changes their coalition and changes their plan and changes their strategy. Republicans have a pretty solid shot, I would say. I mean, you could argue that if Democrats are winning the national vote by a couple points, then Georgia, North Carolina, Arizona, that's a Senate route to a majority before it becomes a presidential route to a majority. But that's also conditional on Democrats getting good candidates in all those places through the primaries. It's plausible. It's not something where, like, if Democrats take the Senate on election night 2020, I'm not going to say, oh, no way, this could have happened. But, you know, it starts off with a Republican edge, I would say.
David Beiler, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. Our episode today was brought to you by ZipRecruiter and by Plexiderm. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.